This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we love to talk about music. We love to talk about race and class, but in a way you've never heard anywhere else. And we love to talk about this a unique experience and this unique thing we call music. Music touches us in ways we don't know, and I wanted to tell the story today about Robert Plant, the lead singer of Led Zeppelin. We had told it before, and we want to tell it again. And Robert Plant, of course, was the lead singer for Led Zeppelin. He fell in love with music because, well, he fell in love with the black experience. And the black experience manifested itself through and in music in this great country, and it went all across the way to the pond, and that is the Atlantic Ocean. And Robert Plant fell in love with music first and first only with the blues music of the Delta. And so we bring you this story about Robert Plant and his connection to America's story. The band, Led Zeppelin. The voice, Robert Plant's.
I can't quit you, babe. So I'm gonna put you down for a while. I said I can't quit you, babe. I guess I got to put you down.
Though British, Led Zeppelin's music was rooted in the American South and blues specifically. That's Robert Plant, Jimmy Page, John Paul Jones, and John Bonham's take on the great Willie Dixon classic. And it appeared on their very first record. The band formed in 1968, made only 9 studio recordings, all of which made it to the top 10 on the Billboard charts. And they sold, get this, 110 million records. The band suffered a huge setback, though, when their drummer, John Bonham, died. And it wasn't long before the band died. They called it quits in 1980. Robert Plant soon found himself out of a job as the lead singer of the world's biggest band. And my goodness, he had no idea what to do next. He talked about the next steps in his journey as an artist.
And when I was 32 and Led Zeppelin finished, and I was just standing there going, wow, I suppose that's a lot then, you know. Perhaps I better do a bit of dry stone walling or something like that, you know. How about being a steeplejack, you know, or if I like the heights. So I was always sort of wobbling around.
Like a lot of artists, wobbling around. Plant spoke about the music that inspired him, the music that drove Zeppelin and also the Rolling Stones, their compatriots, and so many other, well, British boys.
When I was a kid, I was, like so many people of my generation, we were really moved by the deep soul of black American music from Mississippi, from moving, you know, with development and industry up into Chicago and Detroit, down to New Orleans, where nothing really, it was another world, it wasn't even America. But British kids of my age really were so transfixed by the change and by the dynamic of a black culture that we really, really were, these guys became instant heroes. They may have been unsavory, they may have been unlucky, they may have been hellhounds, they could have been anything, but basically there was a lure to the music of the black American which kept us going, the Yardbirds, you know, the Stones, etc.
As time passed and Plant continued to explore different musical styles, he returned again to the American South. This is about the year 2000. But instead of blues music being the inspiration, he rediscovered the roots music he grew up with in England, the songs and music that also inspired country and folk music here. It's known as Americana. Here is Plant talking about that music.
Happened to me later was I found that there was more stuff underneath the covers going on, and it was still coming from Ireland and places in Tennessee and in the mountains where people just hadn't moved on. Families lived there for five generations without shifting from one township, so the music followed down through the families, and we got really old songs there.
Well, after multiple Grammys with Alison Krauss, Plant described the band he formed in 2010, a band with Buddy Miller, Daryl Scott, Patty Griffin, among others. He'd traveled a long way, Plant, a long way from those electrified sounds of Led Zeppelin, and one singer leading a band.
There's loads of ways of skinning a cat, really, and I just think that the Band of Joy here is, there are six voices on this. So sometimes when we hit something like Gallows Pole, it is virtually entirely, apart from a banjo intro, it's a cappella, and it kicks like you wouldn't believe.
This is Lee Habib. You're listening to Our American Stories. When we come back, we will continue with this remarkable story about a man, a British man, who comes to America to discover his own roots, not once, but twice. We'll be back in just a few.
Couldn't get no cold. You know that we're too dead bold. Keep me from the gallows pole. You know that we're too dead bold. Keep you from the gallows pole.
There's loads of ways of skinning a cat, really, and I just think that the Band of Joy here is, there are six voices on this. So sometimes when we hit something like Gallows Pole, it is virtually entirely, apart from a banjo intro, it's a cappella, and it kicks like you wouldn't believe.
And boy, does it kick. Plant went on to discuss his life as an artist. And by the way, artists' life are not always easy. Great success followed by barren periods. And my goodness, the 80s and 90s were barren periods for Robert Plant. Don't go back and listen to that discography. It's not pretty. But he was experimenting, and he wanted to go anew. In fact, at one point during this interview, he said, "What I did not want to do again was become a Robert Plant cover band. There were too many better ones than me." So struggling for the new identity that matched where he was in his life is always the artist's struggle, not to do the same thing again over and over. So Plant discussed his life as an artist and the detours, contours, that made and still make his life as an artist so compelling.
It's been a very strange navigational game, this, which I've enjoyed. I mean, sometimes the shadows that come behind me are a little bit bigger than I need them to be, but it's been great fun. So I've rejected it, I've turned my back on it, and I can't be any of the guys I ever was before, you know? I mean, you've got to evolve is the only way to get through. So, you know, just give me bigger maps.
Just give me bigger maps. And again, the map became the United States. Appalachian music, the hill country music of North Carolina, Virginia, straight down to the roots music of some of his early idols. But in particular, Nashville, which is where he ended up living for a while. Plant never saw himself, we learn in this particular interview, as a great singer. By the way, we'll learn as we profile Billie Holiday in a couple of months that she never saw herself as a great singer. She had wished she had the chops of a Sarah Vaughan. But as Plant points out here, it's precisely because he didn't have those chops that perhaps he brought something else to the table. His real talent? Having the ability to get under the skin of a song and, well, bring it to life.
I just get into songs and live them out, which is a different thing, you know. And I think that's true. If everything else I said wasn't true, that's really true.
That's really true. You know, Jesse, is there a Zeppelin song that's yours? Is there one that?
Oh, it's a bit
you?
On the nose, but Stairway to Heaven's always been a killer.
Yep, it's been, I think, a killer for everybody. I think in every single rock and roll countdown around the country, it's always the number one song.
Definitely.
And it's what? How many years later? 1977, 76?
Before my time.
Yeah, and I've noticed also, Jesse, that you go around and you see, and I live in a great college town. We're in Oxford, Mississippi. And you talk to young people, and Kanye West, Stairway to Heaven, right next to each other on an iPod.
Ugh.
And that's something that's really remarkable about how people are transmitting and gathering their music. It's not categories anymore like when we were kids. Well, here is Plant in a concert performed in 2010 for the BBC. It was with his Band of Joy. He tells a story here about the song he ended this great concert with. A concert, by the way, you can watch by simply Googling the words Band of Joy and BBC. It's an hour-long precious, precious piece of music. Put it on a big screen TV, invite some friends. Well, it's like you're going to a great new concert you never saw before. And by the way, we love doing that here on Our American Stories. Because when you bump into something new that was old, it's new to you. And we're not going to do the news here every night. Because most of what's in the news is, well, nonsense. It's not anything that anyone cares about. Folks just have to fill up the news. And I think if you look carefully at CNN's ratings and Fox's, they don't hold a candle to anything that's on mainstream television or radio. So here's that song that we were talking about. And it's a beautiful example of Plant, quote, living out a song, along with some other extraordinary singers.
Now, you know, I finally got my way after so many thousands of years of saying, why don't you finish the show with a song that says everything? And I tried to sell the idea to a few people down the line, but we've got it now, so. Lay down, my dear sister, won't you lay and take your rest? Won't you lay your head upon my Savior's breast? But I love you, but Jesus loves you the best. And I bid you good night, good night, good night. Oh, I bid you good night, good night, good night.
One of these mornings bright and early and fine.
Good night, good night.
Not a cricket, not a soul to slow me down.
Good night. Good night.
Oh, I'll be walking in the valley of the shadow of death.
Good night. Good night. Good night.
Running a staff will comfort me.
Good night. Good night.
Oh, Jaguar, it's other side.
Good night. Good night.
Oh, just say I've seen another sign.
Tell an A for the art, that wonderful poet. Good night, good night. You know the building of the land getting water to flow. Good night, good night. Tell them B for the beast at the ending of the word. Good night, good night. You know they ate all the children when they wouldn't be good. Good night, good night. I remember quite well, I remember quite well. lay down, my dear sister. Won't you lay and take your head? Won't you lay your head upon my Savior's breast? 'Cause I love you, and Jesus loves you the best. And I bid you good night, good night. Good night.
I was walking in Jerusalem just like John.
Good night, good night.
I was walking in Jerusalem just like John.
Good night, good night. Good night.
That was the bad boy of rock and roll, singing the song he'd wanted to sing all his life on the stage, never having felt comfortable in his own skin, and having a bunch of bandmates who thought it utterly ridiculous to sing a song so beautiful. And have you ever heard something so beautiful from Robert Plant? Sometimes you need to be in your 60s to figure out who you are. I bid you good night. Well, we looked it up. We tried to find the writer. There isn't one. Like so many great old gospel songs, it's just a traditional ballad. He had heard it in the hills of Scotland, and how many young people had heard it in the hills of Appalachia? No difference. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, the life of Robert Plant, his art, his music, and so utterly connected to the American story here on Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib. We'll be right back. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we all think we know something or two about the Boy Scouts, but I don't think we do, and here on this show, we're going to talk about institutions that matter, and this is one of them, one of the most important ones, now sort of slightly, possibly out of fashion, not here. We love the Boy Scouts, and so we throw to our correspondent, John Woods, who, by the way, was himself an Eagle Scout, who spoke with Michael Malone, a fellow Eagle Scout, and an author of two books on the Boy Scouts, and a Pulitzer Prize-winning or Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist.
Give me a history of the Boy Scouts.
Scouting is about 110 years old. American Scouting, the Boy Scouts of America, is 105 years old. It was founded by Lord Baden-Powell, a British general, after the Boer War. He wanted to bring muscular outdoor life back into an Edwardian England, where he thought the boys were getting out of touch and soft. He derived it from two American outdoorsmen, Ernest Thompson Seton and Daniel Carter Beard. In fact, he lifted a lot of Seton's books to create the Boy Scout manual. So scouting very quickly came to the United States and was adopted by a number of different groups. And the one that finally emerged about the beginning of World War One was the Boy Scouts of America. It currently has close to 3 million youth in the organization and about 1 million volunteers in over 100,000 units, from Cub Scout packs all the way up to Explorer posts and Boy Scout troops.
How did the Boy Scouts sort of evolve in Britain? Why did they flourish there?
I think there was a growing sense that, in one respect, it was the Edwardian era. People could feel that war might be coming. Another one was the Industrial Revolution, which hit England first and urbanized a lot of the society. So a lot of boys were living in cities, and they just weren't getting out in the countryside. They weren't camping. They weren't exploring. And there was a great fear that something very British was being lost. In the United States, there was the same sense, though not quite as extreme. There was this feeling that the frontier had officially closed in the 1890s, and that somehow the life of Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett and the great scouts and outdoorsmen was fading away.
You wrote a book called The 4% about the Eagle Scout, the Eagle Scout rank. Who was the first Eagle Scout?
A young man from Long Island named Arthur Eldred Jr. And he looks like every teenage kid you've ever seen. His photograph with his new Eagle medal, and he looks sort of embarrassed standing on the lawn beside his house. But he was a very remarkable young man. He set out to go as far as he could in scouting as quickly as possible. His father had died. His scoutmaster was his older brother. He just really wanted to accomplish something, and what he did was superhuman. He basically earned merit badges as soon as they were announced. Scouting was still unrolling its program and hadn't really planned to see any Eagle Scouts until the end of the decade. And in 1912, Arthur proceeded to earn every merit badge that was being offered, to the point that he had earned more merit badges than entire states of Boy Scouts had. So now scouting had a problem because, and this is a glimpse of what Eagle Scouts are, they accomplish extraordinary things, and no matter what obstacle you put in front of them, they always seem to surmount them quicker than you expect them to. So scouting didn't even have an Eagle medal. They didn't even have a design. They had put a crude design in the scout handbook, but they hadn't even made a prototype. So they had to beg Arthur to wait until, this was beginning of summer, they asked him to wait until fall, till they had a medal they could give to him. So in the meantime, Arthur went off to summer camp, and in the course of the camp there, he proceeded to save the lives of two fellow scouts from drowning. So even as he was waiting for his Eagle medal, he earned, I think, the 30th Boy Scout Honor Medal for saving a life. And he went on to fight in World War I, and I think a couple of his great-grandchildren have just earned their Eagle.
So, Michael, you've written a new book called Running Towards Danger, and that's about the Boy Scout Honor Medal for saving lives. Tell us some stories about that you discuss in your new book about how some of the heroic things that the Boy Scouts have done.
The least celebrated part of scouting, I realized, was the honor medal. And the reason was it's so rare, and it can't really be earned. You can't plan to earn this award. You receive it. It's like the Medal of Honor. And there's only been 13,000 out of 100 million scouts over the last century that have earned any kind of honor medal. And when you get down to the honor medal for saving a life, especially the honor medal, that medal with the cross palms on it, which means extreme risk to one's own life, even the loss of one's own life in a rescue, the numbers are down around 1,500. So it is so rare, most of us involved in scouting have never seen anybody with an honor medal. And yet the achievements of these scouts are unbelievable. As I wrote this book, my jaw was hanging down all the way through. I couldn't believe that 8-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 20-year-olds could do some of these extraordinary rescues. So let me give you one. Two boys, this is 1930s, two boys want to see if they can make sparks off a trolley line, power line going overhead. So they find a long wire and they fling it over the top of these wires. And as it hits, one of the kids didn't let go. And so he's getting hit with 10,000 volts of electricity, knocks him to the ground, literally burns one of his hands off. And he's lying there crackling and hissing and burning. A paper boy comes riding by, Boy Scout, sees this, jumps off his bike, runs over to try to pull the kid away from the wire. And as he does, he's knocked backwards in a backflip, unconscious from the shock. So he revives himself, gets up, and realizes he's got to find an insulator, runs back, takes two newspapers, and wraps them around his hands like gloves, and runs back and manages to pull the wire off and saves the kid, drags him away, thinks he's dead, and then the boy revives. The boy literally is electrified. His skin is electrified for the next 24 hours. The boy goes, the scout, the kid who did the saving, goes home, goes to bed, doesn't even tell his parents, wakes up with burned palms of his hands, but otherwise okay. They have to find him to honor him. In the book I wrote, I have 170 of these individuals. Some of them did extraordinary rescues without risking their own lives. Some of them died in the process.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we've come back more with our correspondent and our own Eagle Scout, John Woods, and he'll be speaking more with Michael Malone, a fellow Eagle Scout, an author of two books on the Boy Scouts, and a Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist. And again, one of the things we're going to do with this show is talk about institutions that matter and the stories about those institutions. My goodness, I learned a whole lot there. And when we come back, we're going to play a little more of that conversation. And then I have John in the studio, and I'm going to talk to John about, well, what he learned from the Scouts and what he learned from Michael as he started to write about the Scouts. You know, we were talking just before the segment started, and you know, we all have our biases and prejudices when we're hiring, and of course it can't be about race and age and gender, because that's a terrible thing. But let me tell you, I see Eagle Scout, boy, your paper's going to the top of the pile. Some people valedictorian, not me. Valedictorian, eh. In part, that might mean to me you're a real conformist. That mean you want the A so bad you'll do anything. I like the guy who's got five A's and a D, because I want to know why he got the D. And if that D is, I disagree with my professor, boy, top of the pile. Top of the pile. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And we're talking about the Boy Scouts. We're talking with our correspondent and fellow Eagle Scout. By the way, I know a lot about John. He just dropped that E-bomb on me. The E-bomb. And by the way, that's Eagle Scouts. They're humble. They learn this. Very good. Very smart. They are who they are. More after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we love to bring you stories about every walk of life, and we're talking about the Boy Scouts today, and we're going to pick up where we left off with our own field correspondent, Eagle Scout John Woods, and again, we just learned about that today. I've known John for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, and he just dropped that E-bomb on me, and I'm going to call it the E-bomb the way young guys drop the H-bomb on girls, if you remember from the movie that Matt Damon was in. What was that? The one you won the Oscar for Best Screenplay with Robin Williams, Good Will Hunting. It was dropping the H-bomb. You would tell girls you went to Harvard, and they'd get all excited. Me, it doesn't mean anything to me, the H-bomb, but the E-bomb is big. And John's conversation with Michael Malone, a fellow Eagle Scout, and an author of two books on the Boy Scouts. He also happens to be a Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist. More of that conversation.
Do we know how many people have been saved as a result of Scouts?
Yeah, we did a little demographic analysis when we were writing this book. You know, you look at a certain number of individuals, and you follow them down through generations. And the number we came up with, coming from 13,000 honor medals or medals of merit, which are the ones you're given for not risking your own life. Of those 13,000 going through the generations, we think that somewhere between 3 million and 5 million Americans are alive today because either they, their parents, or one of their grandparents were saved by a Boy Scout. So we're looking at Houston or maybe Chicago of people who owe their lives to a Boy Scout. it's so rare. It shows up as a newspaper story, but it's always a local newspaper story. And so we have no sense of the overall magnitude of what's been accomplished here. I mean, this is the greatest life-saving program ever devised.
Michael, what makes scouting so unique in a way that it turns boys into men, or sometimes girls into women, in a way that other youth programs don't? What makes it so unique and valuable?
I think the three-dimensional nature of scouting, that to outsiders, scouting is this image of 11-year-olds sitting around a campfire, you know, tying knots. And in fact, that is a tiny fraction of what scouting is. That's part of the appeal of scouting. That's what gets boys to join, the chance to get away from their parents and go camping and do outdoor stuff. But scouting also is the largest teacher of first aid. Scouting is also the patrol. It centers around the patrol, which is the very first leadership training most boys ever receive. And as they move up through the ranks, some of them become senior patrol leader, where they're managing, literally managing, 70 or 80 scouts. The Eagle Project is the only program, Eagle Service Project is the only program for youth that I know of that is the equivalent of being a project manager for a Fortune 50 corporation. So scouting is giving you a skill set, it's giving you a survival set, it's giving you first aid. And I read one study that found that 50% of all Eagle Scouts will save somebody's life during their life using those skills. So that's an amazing number in itself. And then there's management training, and there's leadership training, and then those merit badges, which everyone jokes about. A third of them are the old Boy Scout camping and hiking and that. The rest is all adult career training. Most Eagle Scouts, for example, found their adult career earning a merit badge. I found mine getting the journalism merit badge, and I've been a writer now for 45 years. There's nothing in boyhood. That's why it's called, the Eagle Scout is called the PhD of boyhood, because there's nothing else that gives you all of those things you need for adulthood.
Now, you said that lots of Boy Scouts will find their job through the merit badges they earn. And certainly 50 years ago, that could have been true with, you know, farming merit badges and things, you know, more agrarian in nature. But for the urban scout, the modern scout, what kind of merit badges are available? What is the Boy Scouts doing to attract and develop the modern boy?
Oh, that's interesting. You know, a lot of those merit badges that you think of have been retired in the 1940s, reflecting the heavily rural nature of American life. Yeah, you could earn poultry raising and farm management and pig raising and all these other things. They're all gone. Now you get computers and you get game design and composite materials. I mean, these are pretty sophisticated, state-of-the-art merit badges. Basically, and the merit badges are all constructed the same way. You have to participate in the actual field. You have to study the nature of careers in that field. You have to go out and design things and learn a set of skills. You're basically getting the basic training of every profession that you can possibly think of. And I'm here in Silicon Valley, and the latest merit badges are specifically designed really to put you on a path in a world of the World Wide Web and computers. Some of my Eagle Scouts are now working for Apple Computer and a number of other companies around here, and I know they credit their merit badge training for helping them get there.
So you wrote in the Wall Street Journal recently that scouting is searching for a new path. What is that new path?
Yeah, you know, the irony of life is that you're oftentimes more in danger in the aftermath of successfully surviving a crisis than you are in the crisis itself. And so scouting mobilized and went through a great soul searching on the membership question about gay scouts and then gay leaders. And I thought it got through it with great dignity. I was in the thick of it all, and I thought scouting behaved quite well. I was very impressed. But now that those things are behind us, now that scouting has fully reasserted itself in American culture, there's a kind of an exhaustion that's set in and a little bit of a confusion of what is our role now and where do we go. And Scouting is going to have to make some important choices in the next few years to decide whether it's going to be narrowly focused, you know, go back to old scouting, which is a sort of a hermetic organization of maybe half or a quarter of as many members, but they're very much into camping and the outdoors and all of those things, or scouting remains universal and expansive and tries to reach out to every boy between the ages of, say, 6 and 18, or boys and girls, as it is now, with venturing and exploring up to the age of 21. Whether it scouting should try to be for everybody or just for people with a penchant for the scouting life. And I think that's it's a very important debate scouting is going to have. It's going to have to make some very important decisions very soon. Now is the time. The door is finally open again, and scouting needs to decide if it's going to march through or it's going to stay where it is. And I think scouting is too important to American life not to play its traditional role.
And that was, again, our Eagle Scout, our correspondent here at Our American Stories, John Woods, talking to Michael Malone, a fellow Eagle Scout and an author of two books on the Boy Scouts and a Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist. John, just real briefly, where do you think it's going to go with the Boy Scouts, the old narrow way or the expansive way?
No, I think the way the Boy Scouts have been conducting themselves for the last several years, I think we're definitely looking at expanding the Boy Scouts' appeal to the broader marketplace of boys out there. At least I hope it does. It seems to be right now. I think that's the way they should go, and it will be the best for boys and for America, I think.
You bet. And tell me about what you learned. If you give me just a snapshot, what's the best thing you learned from being an Eagle Scout? And by the way, humility is one of them, because, again, I've known you 5 years. I just found out about this. But what's the most important thing you learned from your scout training?
You know, I think hands down, I think if you talk to a lot of Boy Scouts about this, Philmont Ranch is one of the things that's offered to you as a Boy Scout. It's a ranch in New Mexico, and you can go there for 2 weeks during the summer. My personal trek, I was the youngest guy there that summer. I was 15 at the time, leading a troop of about 15 other boys. We walked 100 miles, even though we're only supposed to walk 90. But it taught me about self-reliance and independence in a way that for years afterwards, I would always think, you know, I've pushed harder, I've been colder, I've been hotter. You know, I did that, I can do this. And up until the point that I just got out of the Army's infantry officer course, and that was hands down the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
Well, we all need harder experiences in our lives. I mean, we did a segment on Coach Saban, and he had talked about what made him the coach he was, and it was his father. He was a tough man. And even the car washing duties he had, his father owned a service station in a town, a coal mining town, John, that had 10 roads. And he said, my dad would make me clean the cars for the customers. And if there was so much as any smudge, it wasn't clean the smudge, do over. He would wet the whole car and make them do it again and again. And the interviewer on 60 Minutes went, so I guess that's where you had your attention to detail and your toughness. And he goes, you betcha I did. And there's not a lot of coddling at Boy Scouts, is there, John?
No, absolutely not.
And that's what we're going to be digging into in this show. We're going to be dealing with a lot more on this Boy Scouts topic. We had not thought about it before in this way. But now this, I believe, will be a regular feature. We'll be bringing John in on this. He's got a couple of stories of heroism I just don't think we have the time to dig into. But I think in the next segment, that's what we're going to do. Because it's the stories in the end that are going to move folks. We've got some of the background. We got some of the history. You heard one story here from a young man, and John's in his mid-20s, and talking about scout, and he will be talking about scouting, even I believe into his 60s and 70s, as a seminal experience that shaped his life. Not enough in this country for boys, or for girls for that matter, to teach us how to be men and women. And that's what we love to talk about here on Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and you are listening to Michael Malone, a fellow Eagle Scout of John's, an author of two books on the Boy Scouts, and a Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist. This is Our American Stories. You can hear all of this on OurAmericanNetwork.org. That's OurAmericanNetwork.org. Thank you. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And each week, we like to bring you, well, the running report on Shark Tank. Well, this past week, Jess and Sarah, well, they came into the tank. And again, the tank is filled with billionaires and almost billionaires who were self-made, being pitched by various Americans from every walk of life. And that's why we love the show. Jess and Sarah, well, they're there and they want $50,000, well, for a piece of their all-natural deodorant brand.
Hi, Sharks. I'm Jess.
And I'm Sarah. We're asking for $50,000 in exchange for 10% of our company, Piper Y.
The toxic ingredients in conventional deodorant and antiperspirant have potential links to cancer and Alzheimer's. The problem is we've never found a natural deodorant that actually keeps body odor at bay all day. That's why we created Piper Y, a new approach to deodorant that really, truly works.
Our proprietary blend of unique ingredients like super absorbent activated charcoal completely neutralize odor instead of just covering it up.
Hengel, you should be investing in this.
I have a deodorant rant, actually. This is great. Yeah, this is exactly what I'm looking for.
Well, you keep listening, okay? Right, maybe you should put some capital behind this.
Oh, yeah.
So the girls invite the Sharks to smell the armpit of a fitness model they have on set that's been working out all day.
This is our friend, health and fitness guru, Noelle Ellie. When Noelle woke up this morning, she applied Piper Y, went on a 5-mile run, and has been working out on that mat ever since. Sharks, in a moment when Noelle hands out samples, we invite you to smell for yourself just how well Y keeps Noelle
to
feeling
sniff
fresh
Noelle?
And dry all day long.
Usually we're not allowed to sniff
It's
the
a
bottles.
Scratch and sniff.
To demonstrate that natural deodorant doesn't have to stink.
Ugh. Ugh. Thank goodness it wasn't me working out all day.
You just got to take your hand and kind of wave it in your face.
Exactly. Move it around. Wave? Move the air around. Wave, wave.
Is that a word?
Wave.
It is now.
So most of the Sharks declined the offer to a smell test on an armpit, but QVC Queen Lori, well, she dives right in there.
I'm not going to smell her armpit.
Is it your armpit?
It is my armpit.
All right, I don't care. It's fine.
You
it's
did
fine,
not
right?
do that.
It's fine. I did do it.
I had my official
fine.
Tester check it
all
out.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We'll trust Lori.
She smelled good.
So all armpit sniffing aside, what do the numbers look like and smell like?
Since we launched 18 months ago, we've had 110,000 in sales.
Not bad.
You do a marketing campaign.
All earned
all
media.
All word of mouth, all earned media. We gave samples to journalists and bloggers and friends and family and everyone we knew. And they told everyone they knew because it works. And when people try a natural deodorant,
how much
it
do you
works,
sell it for?
$11.99 plus shipping on our website.
What does it cost?
It's $2.74.
And those would be some nice
margins.
Very nice margins. So how does this product and business work?
It's our proprietary blend of essential oils. They contain antimicrobial properties, which actually help in the odor neutralizing process. So the reason we smell bad is the sweat that comes out of your armpits is actually odorless, but it starts to sink when the naturally occurring bacteria on your skin gets to it. Piper Y works by neutralizing odor. It creates a pH-balanced environment where the odor-causing bacteria can't thrive, so your sweat remains odorless.
Wow, we could all use some of that in this room. Mr. Wonderful, Robert, and Mark Cuban. Well, in or out, guys.
I don't think anything you've done is horrible. It's just I don't see how you can protect this and become very big at it. I can just see you on the sidewalk. Gone. I'm
can
out.
I say something to you guys?
Not every deal is for every shark. This one's not for me. I'm out.
Look, guys, I'm out. I think you're not being self-aware enough, and I think that's a huge problem you have to be careful of.
Self-aware? What is he talking
about? I don't know. I don't get it. He didn't like it. Why don't you just leave it at that?
Yeah, what's the self-aware
thing? Enough. Well, Barbara, she feels differently. She's willing to offer up the 50K, but boy, she wants a lot more in return.
I'm going to offer you the $50,000, but I want 35%.
Ooh.
Oh. Why? What's the difference?
Are you just like digging up Barbara?
Ouch. Well, if you thought that was tough, Lori comes in after sniffing an armpit, and there's going to be a price to pay for that. 50K?
Lori, will you go down to 25% for $50,000?
Wow.
Guys, I would have to really give you a lot of time and attention. Personal. My entrepreneurs get me. I'm on the phone with them. I'm calling the buyers. I'm doing the packaging. I'm working with
She's
them hand
partner.
In hand. But I can't help you and really take over and make this work and give you all of that dedication for 25%. Barbara, would you go down to 25%?
Absolutely not.
Wow.
Wow.
Jess and Sarah make a final plea to Barbara to come down in her percentage. Will she budge?
We're both in Manhattan. It'd be a great partnership. It's, you know, we obviously have a lot of potential here. And
she said
we
she's
all
sticking.
Have a very similar background to you. I used to flip real estate in Manhattan. Jess is a realtor part-time. She's willing to give that up for the company. We're very smart. Like, we know how we can deal with a lot of the minor issues in the business. We don't need complete oversight.
I don't mistrust you at all.
Yeah. I
Not
think,
at all.
Would you be willing to go down to 25%?
Yes, I will.
What?
Deal.
Deal.
We built this baby from nothing, and we turned it into a business, and now we have...
And at the last minute, we thought it wasn't going to happen, and it did, and we are so, so happy with the outcome.
Well, great job by Jess and Sarah. That was a showdown. There were some deadly silences and pauses, and those girls stuck to their guns and brought Barbara down to their level. And by the way, you get to watch some pretty interesting negotiating here on Shark Tank.
I'm not going to smell her armpit.
Is it your armpit?
It is my armpit.
Right, I don't care.
I don't care.
And I'm already doing my research. This is a cream deodorant, which is very interesting.
Very interesting. Well, you get that.
It's fine.
You
it's
did
fine,
not
right?
do that.
It's fine.
You get that rant ready for the deodorant. I can't wait to hear that because we already know that epic wet wipes rant was what started the rants in particular. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Story. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And on this day in history, the Eagles were number one on the U.S. album charts with Hotel California, the group's third U.S. number one album. Well, we did a long segment on this a while back, celebrating the life of Joe Walsh. And so we wanted to bring you this story about the song Hotel California, and also about the inclusion of Joe Walsh in this band that made the band something even more special than before. Young Joe Walsh was born in Wichita, Kansas, the son of Robert Newton Fiddler and grandson of Alden Ellison Fiddler and Dora J. Newton. Walsh's mother was classically trained as a pianist, and Walsh was adopted by his stepfather at the age of five after his biological father was killed in a plane crash. Walsh moved around a lot as a young man, an itinerant family, Columbus, Ohio for a while, New Jersey, Montclair, just miles from my home, where I grew up, then into New York City, and then into a series of bands. 1965, The Measles. That's a big band. Got to fix that name, guys.
Great name, yeah.
Great name. The James Gang, of course, is where he really got his, you know, got his name and reputation. Folks like Eric Clapton took notice, and Jimmy Page. And then he went on and kept wandering around the Barnstorm. And then in 1975, well, it was time for him to join a little band called the Eagles. And I don't know if you've seen the documentary on the life story of the Eagles. And no matter how you feel about the Eagles, whether you like them or not, watch this. Because it's a remarkable history of a bunch of guys who were just trying to make some music together. And we're going to dip into that a bit. Because what was happening to the Eagles as they were going into their next record after a last hit record, their first number one record, was what were they going to do to repeat it? And we hear now from Glenn Frey on why they needed a guy like Joe Walsh to join the band on their 1975 tour.
Joe Walsh was a bona fide rock and roll guitar player. So for a couple of those shows, just for our encores, we put Joe Walsh in a road box, and we come back to do an encore, and we'd roll the road box out, and just like the model jumping out of a cake, we'd open the guitar case, and there would be Joe Walsh with his Les Paul, and he'd climb out of the box and plug in, and the Eagles, we would play Rocky Mountain Way. I love the way he played. I'd loved the James Gang when I was growing up in Detroit. Now I started thinking, Joe Walsh for Bernie Ledden.
Spent the last year Washington, D.C. way. Couldn't get much higher.
Okay, maybe the vocals won't be quite as good, but boy, are we gonna kick some ass.
I think one of the things that I brought into the band that was good for the band was to bring it up a notch when we played live. Just keep kicking it in the butt a little bit, you know?
And what a sound, and what a difference. Walsh was a real wild man, trashed rooms, got in trouble, had real drug problems for the longest time. And here was a story of Walsh on tour in Chicago and meeting another pretty famous partier and carouser from Saturday Night Live and movie fame.
We were in Chicago, and we were staying at the Astor Towers.
In Chicago, here's what happened. There was a knock on the door, and in walked John Belushi. John wanted to show me the finer restaurants of Chicago. So we went to the restaurant and they wouldn't let us in because we had jeans. And he got the maitre d' up to like $300 bribe, and still they would not let us in. And John said, I know what to do. I know what to do. And the next thing I knew, we were standing in the alley and he spray painted my jeans black and then made me do his. And we went back, and we got in. We were sitting in these Queen Anne period chairs that had needlepoint, and when we stood up, that was all black, and the butts of our pants were jeans again, so we had to kind of back out of there and leave fast. But that was the beginning of it.
That was the beginning of it.
We
what
just
a great
happen
story.
To have a can of spray paint.
I know. How about
that? I want to know that part of the story.
They probably hit an auto body shop or just, you know, did what they had to do.
Yeah.
What a great story. And you know that story happened because you can't make that one up. It's impossible. So why was Walsh so wild back then, destroying rooms, the whole nine yards?
I was insecure always and afraid. So I hid behind all of my hang-ups with humor.
You know, we hear that over and over again as we do our portraits of artists. We heard this from Al Pacino. He was shy. We heard this from Johnny Carson. He was shy. We heard this from Martin Scorsese. He was asthmatic, couldn't play sports, and so he hung out in movie theaters with his family. And go figure. And Hengler over here, who is an actor, I mean, you couldn't get a word out of him until you asked him what really bugged him. And then you can't shut him up. So it turns out that, well, the rock god that was Joe Walsh, this hard, heavy rock blues player, was most intimidated by the two guys in this band, the Pretty Boys, the guys who got all the girls and played this sort of California mellow country music, Don Henley and Glenn Frey.
I was totally in awe of Don and Glenn. I was intimidated by Don and Glenn because they sang so good and they were writing stuff I could never come close to writing.
It's nice to hear a musician admit that. So many times people pick a particular style of music and then sort of excoriate or just sort of cast out all others. And here's this just almost rock god admitting that he wishes he could have written some pop hits. And he wishes he could sing like these guys, especially Henley, who almost everyone says, who sings, that he's a singer's singer. And, well, they were in a pickle, the Eagles. They had to follow up their number one record one of these nights. It was their first number one record, and what to do. They needed something really big. And here's Don Felder.
With Joe in the band with me, I wanted to write something musically that would fit two guitar players, that we could play off of each other. So I was sitting on a sofa in Malibu at this rental house that I had on the beach. I was playing this acoustic guitar, and this introduction came out, that progression. I kept playing it three or four times. I had an old reel-to-reel tape recorder. So I went back and recorded that introduction to that song and laid down that progression. Made a mix of it and put it on a cassette with, I don't know, the other 14 or 15 pieces of music that I had assembled. And I gave a copy of the cassette to Don, one to Glenn.
Don Felder used to send Henley and I instrumental tapes, song ideas. 95% of them were cluttered with guitar licks, and we would, you know, listen to these things and go, well, where do you sing? As Don and I were listening through one of the Felder cassettes and this song came up, you know, we both sort of said, now this is interesting.
The music sounded to me like some sort of a cross between Spanish music and reggae music. And that one really jumped out at me.
So we set out to write a song to that progression. I'm pretty sure it was Henley's idea to have a song called Hotel California.
When we come back, we're going to hear a lot more about this masterpiece, how it was made. You're going to hear from the producer. You're going to hear more from the band. And you'll hear the song itself. Hotel California became a number one album again. Two in a row. And that is damn hard to do in anything. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. On this day in history, Hotel California became number one. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and you're hearing the Gypsy Kings version. of the Eagles' massive hit, Hotel California. And to give you an idea of how big a hit it was, get this, 32 million records sold. That's just a big wow. 42 million greatest hits, 160 million records the Eagles sold in a decade. Quite stunning. Well, we had just learned about the pressure they had to follow up on the last number one record they had. And, well, it turns out that Hotel California wasn't just a musical masterpiece. As Bill Simzik explains, the record's producer, it was a lyrical masterpiece, and the lyrics created some real stories and mythologies.
I think Henley's and Glenn's lyric writing really came to a head. They became real honest-to-God songwriters then. During the recording of it, I thought that we were on to something. I knew we were on to something.
We were in a really creative phase, and it just so happened that Bill Simzik pushed record. Thank God.
Asked a million times, what does that song mean? Don and I were big fans of hidden deeper meaning. You know, you write songs and you send them out to the world.
So I called up the captain, please bring me my wine. He said, we haven't had that spirit here since 1969.
And maybe somewhere in that song is some stuff that's just yours that they're never gonna figure out.
There's been a great deal of ridiculous speculation about that song over the years. I mean, it's really taken on a life or a mythology of its own. You know, it's sort of like the Paul is dead thing or who was the walrus.
Bring your alibis.
Henley, by the way, in the documentary went on to describe the song as a journey from innocence to experience. And that was it. That was the impetus for the song. And where it takes you from there, he just said, look, it's up to you. By the way, that's true of so much great poetry, and I think that's so true of so much great art. And I think that's what's truly astounding about Hotel California. It can mean what you want it to mean at different times. But what really made this song special was this guitar section towards the end, featuring Don Felder and Joe Walsh, too. And here they are talking about their dueling guitars.
You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave.
Whereas Felder was technically very, very good, Walsh brought spontaneity to it. And the two of them playing off each other was just brilliant.
A lot of great respect for each other. There was always a little competition between Felder and I. We always tried to kind of one-up each other, you know? And that's really healthy. It always made the song better when we were kind of, oh yeah, listen to this.
And then came that famous ending. And here is Felder, followed by producer Bill Simczyk, talking about this amazing 7-minute single.
We got to the end where now is the harmony guitars that are playing together. And Joe said, we should do something that's like da 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 da.
The ending of Hotel California. That's one of my high points of my entire recording career. To have a 7-minute single be number one, that was unheard of. The record company said, you got to do an edit, you got to do an edit. And we all said, no, take it or leave it. And they took it.
And that, by the way,
we had no idea that that song would affect as many people on the planet as it did.
They wouldn't. How could you? And again, that's the artist and their instinct. The label is telling them to cut it and fix it, and time after time after time, probably the market testers too. And what do these guys say? Take it or leave it. Take it or leave it. And thank goodness. I mean, could you imagine what they would have cut? They would have cut the guitar solos.
It was pretty remarkable, too, that the rendition we just heard was live. And considering how long they'd been playing, to have those two guitars in tune with each other at the end of the song after you've been wailing on your guitar for 7 minutes is incredible.
It's extraordinary. And especially the way Walsh plays, because Walsh digs into those strings. And they are such different players, Felder and Walsh. And I love the way they described. One was Mr. Precision, Mr. Studio Guy, and the other guy was Mr. Raw Emotion. And to stick them together and have them duel it out is just, it's beautiful, actually.
This could be heaven or this could be hell. It kind of speaks to the duality of the guitars there.
That does. And this is sounding like Rock Criticism 101 here. I love it. And this is Our American Stories. And also on this album, we're going to go out with this song. It's the only song that Joe Walsh is a featured singer on it. And it's Pretty Maids All in a Row. And again, this is Hotel California. And my goodness, over 30 million sales. And number one on the charts. This is Lee Habib. And this is Our American Stories.